Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm Paul David, CEO and co-founder of Literal Humans, joined by my esteemed colleague today.
Will GP, the co-founder and chief strategy officer of Literal Humans. Great to be here.
And we're joined today by Josiah Keel, CEO of Sprocket Games. Welcome to the pod, Josiah.
Thank you.
We're very excited. This is, I think, our first podcast about gaming. I know Will's very excited. He's a big gamer. And yeah, let's get into it. First things first, Josiah, I would love to just give the audience a synopsis about who you are, what you're up to these days, and what kind of work you're doing right now.
Yeah, so as mentioned, I'm the CEO of Sprocket Games. We are a venture-backed video game studio. We just started operations this past summer, so I guess July. So it's been maybe six or seven months now, which means we haven't built a whole lot, but we're deep into prototype land.
Very cool. Very cool. Where'd you get the name Sprocket from?
Apart from the name just sounding cool, like Sprockets are, yeah. It's a neat word. The first person that I called up, Nick Titley, who is now our CTO, he's big into motorcycles and I'm into like road bikes and bikes. And both of those make heavy use of sprockets. So we're familiar with the mechanical object. And we're like, well, this is just a cool word that nobody else is using, so let's use the cool word.
Nice.
Love it.
We love a good name in the marketing profession, so well done, well named.
Thank you.
Well, as we typically do, let's jump into some of the headlines, and we try to keep the headlines that we talk about at the top of the show relevant to our guests' sector. So we're going to talk about Web3 and gaming tech and a little bit of AI and how that relates to gaming. So yeah, the first piece we share with you was from MarTech Series and talks about the impact of Web3 on the gaming market. You know, they talk about some stuff that's already happening with Web3 and gaming right now. So, you know, creating greater transparency, creating more of a player-focused gaming experience, and some potential new stuff that's integrating right now, like blockchain technology, digital wallets, smart contracts, things that are kind of level up gaming. So super curious to hear your perspective about, you know, the ways in which Web3 is becoming a more and more significant aspect of the gaming industry.
Yeah, that is, we could make a whole podcast about this one. It has definitely made waves in the last few years. So Web3, blockchain, the whole thing. And probably the biggest impact that I've seen is on venture capital and what they're excited about, as is their role in the industry. They are always looking for the next big thing and looking for something that has the potential to take off and show that exponential growth that they're trying to achieve. And blockchain and Web3 and all of that looked like it was that for a long time. Though I would challenge the premise a little bit, saying that it has not yet had an impact on the games industry. Even though it's made a lot of headlines and there's a lot of investment, we haven't really seen a whole lot of positive upside from it yet. And it hasn't really fundamentally changed the way we think about games in any way yet. Maybe sometime in the future, somebody will push through a breakthrough that will then make a significant change. But if we look at any of the metrics that have been pulled in like the last, I don't know, 6 months or so, for the most part, the games industry at large isn't really looking at Web3 at all. There is a niche that it probably fits very well, and those are people who really value making money or playing markets. But in my experience, that's not most of gamers. And so I think it will serve some people extremely well. And I think maybe it currently serves those people extremely well. I think it has a long way to go before it could be considered anything mass market.
Yeah, it's interesting. In many ways, like a large part of Web3 is this concept of the metaverse. And in many ways, like video games already are a Web3. Like, you know, that's in many ways what like Mark Zuckerberg is actually trying to replicate. It's like, hey, you have this 3D digital avatar and you can interact with people and you can go on fun adventures. It's like, yeah, dude, that's a video game, but like to a much mass market. And yeah, like you said, I did find in that piece a lot of the stuff I was like, I'm, you know, as a pretty invested gamer, I'm not sure I'd be interested in most of those sort of avenues the piece was talking about. The one that I did think was a little interesting, again, it's funny how much you realize much of Web3 is actually replicating gaming in many behaviors, but you know, the use of rewards that you get as you game, those unaware of it, basically the more you play a video game, there are increasingly difficult challenges and that you get little digital trophies. And like some of them are very easy. It's like, oh, you've played for 10 hours. Others are like, you finish this game on the hardest setting with one hand tied behind your back. Only 0.3% of gamers get this. And I thought that system being translated into NFTs that you could then, as a gamer, sell to other gamers as a sort of digital collectible, that was probably the only thing I could see like, oh, you could do that quite quickly. Like that seems like the tech and the alignment between trophies and NFTs is sort of already there. But yeah, even there, it's a bit more of a sort of fun gimmicky sort of thing rather than like a proper mechanic of the game itself. But yeah, that was the only bit that I thought, oh, that would be quite cool. Like, you know, if I got rewarded for all of this and then maybe I could sell this thing for like $200 to somewhat justify the 10,000 hours of gameplay I've just put into this thing.
For sure. And I think those sorts of things are, if you talk to proponents of the tech, which I think is a really good idea, is you don't want to just talk to cynics and skeptics. You want to talk to people who are really excited about it and learn from them what's really exciting. And so often I do. And what they will point to is, as you said, games have been doing this for 30 years, right? And now there's a bit of new technology that they hope will level up the experience in the ways that you're describing, with the concept of like true ownership or decentralized ownership is something that's new and different. If we look at, say, past Diablo games or World of Warcraft, where people do actually sell items. And in fact, Diablo 3 had a real money auction house built into the game. And World of Warcraft, while it's not sanctioned by Blizzard, you can buy and sell characters and items and other things for real money and just hope you don't get banned for it. But they do this. One thing you find is the rest of the gaming community will instantly devalue that item as soon as it's sellable. Because if you can just buy your way to victory, people no longer view it as skill expression. It's no longer, I spent 10,000 hours learning to play this game and look at this great achievement. It's like, well, did you actually achieve it? Or did you spend $200 and just display it? If that's not transparent of whether you bought it or achieved it, it's instantly devalued and people stop caring about it. And so because we've seen that pattern play out in the past, going forward, we need to be really careful with how we implement new systems and make sure we isolate achievement from what you can buy.
That's a very fair point. I think the other thing that kind of I thought would be quite cool is like almost NFTs almost become micro DLCs, where it's just like, you know, say a big game developer like Activision just does like an Easter egg sort of roulette where you get an NFT and then you chuck that NFT into the game and then you get a custom gun in code or something based on the NFT, and there's massive variations of rarity. But yeah, again, it really, to your point, it is kind of just you are almost replicating stuff that they already do and finding a way to justify putting it on blockchain and via NFTs. And it's like, you know, within the world of COD, because it's a closed garden, you can guarantee that the collectibles and the items that you receive are unique. Like, don't get me wrong, you have to take the, you know, the gaming developer's word for it, but it's not like you need blockchain to back that up. You can take within reason COD's word for it that this gun only exists in your usability. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see if someone does come up with a good concept for it, but it feels like there's something there, but no one's quite nailed it yet.
Yeah, I think that's the right way to think about it. It's like, while it's interesting technology, it still very much feels like a research project where the technology works, and the fundamental, from at least a gameplay perspective, the fundamental difference between what we used to have and what we have now is, in the past, like you're describing, we would have like a centralized database that the company owns, and they can control the number of things that go into that database, so they can enforce scarcity if they want to. And games have been doing that since the beginning. Like, there's, you beat the big boss and you get the one sword. There's only one of them, and they've enforced scarcity because they control the database. And for most players, that's enough, because they don't, like, they're never going to trade that outside of that game's ecosystem, because it doesn't mean anything in any other game. And what we have now is a decentralized database. That's new and different. And the big question is, does that make a better player experience? Because the game itself is still going to be centralized. Call of Duty is still going to be run by Activision. And even if the database that is underlying the items system or the inventory system in that game is decentralized, the game itself is centralized. And so it's like, all right, I have this extra capability that ultimately ends up centralized anyway. And so people will talk about, the theory is, well, what if you could move items and characters and things you purchase from game to game? What if that's the new way, the new player experience that you could achieve with this decentralized database, where like 10 studios all sign into this one blockchain and they are all building on the same tech? So then if I kill the big bad boss over here, I get the sword and I can take it over to this other game. And then now I have a sword in two games. That sounds compelling until you start considering the multiplicative impact on game development that has. It's already difficult to make enough content for your own game. Now imagine you have to make not only your own set of items, but then everybody else's items that they've made in all of their games too. And so there's a lot of neat ideas that have really difficult practical implications, and maybe somebody will come up with it. Maybe AI is the answer to this, like, who knows? But because they're big on answered questions, it's very much a research project.
Yeah, it's an interesting segue into gaming topics. I mean, the next piece we share with you from The Guardian talks about, you know, how 2023 could potentially change the gaming market. And I thought one of the more interesting predictions from this piece came from Lucy Blundell, who's an award-winning game developer. And she talks about this new generation of player creators, you know, coming up with games that are focused more on gender, sexuality, mental health, you know, using cheap development tools and kind of angling it towards the topics that Gen Z is a bit more interested in. So curious to hear if you think that prediction is going to pan out, if you're seeing anything in the market, you know, leaning towards that, that sort of verifies that.
I think this is a trend we've seen for at least the last decade, where as tools get better and better and better, it lowers the barrier to entry for creating anything. And you can even go as far as saying, like, looking at platforms like Roblox, where just about anybody can make a game. It may not look like Call of Duty, or it might not look like Assassin's Creed, but it is a game, and sometimes there's very compelling experiences made with what is essentially the Lego form of game development. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe you don't have to learn C++ and Unreal Engine and all of these other very advanced tools to make an experience that has a specific point, and like, especially with things like gender expression and equality and more current topics, sometimes being timely is more important than being polished. Mm-hmm. And these more advanced tools allow people to say what they want to say without a 5-year development cycle. Mm-hmm. And so that's really optimistic, I think, because if you make a really focused experience, you probably can get that out in a month or two. And maybe that's a better medium than writing a blog post or something.
Mm. Yeah, I do hope that indification of games, like there's two points there. One is like, yeah, it'd be awesome if a new generation, as they kind of already have shown, have become empowered, that rather than writing a blog post about gender equality, they're like, why don't I just design a game that can teach this to people? Like that, like that's really cool and really exciting. The other is I do hope that we see is like what I'd say the kind of step up in sophistication there in terms of people who are probably also looking at like games development as a career start to have the ability to kind of almost have a side gig where they develop indie games that focus so much more on creative concept rather than polish, because you, as we've seen sort of the last 5-10 years, there's been some exceptions, but the only thing that's really changed in video games is they've become a lot cooler and more polished from the big studios. And Call of Duty from 2012 and Call of Duty from 2022, I don't realize there's some massive exceptions, but like it is the same fundamental game without any incredibly unique creative idea. Whereas then you see some of the more indie games come out and you're like, okay, well, yeah, this is like 32-bit, something I would have played on a Super SNES like back in the day, but the concept is mental. Like, you know, Shovel Knight, no big AAA games developer would greenlight those concepts, but an indie developer put them together. And I kind of hope that as that software becomes more available, there are some people that abuse it and create shit out of it, but there are also some people that like probably couldn't have created a game using anything else, and they just focus entirely on creativity rather than sort of polish and graphics, and then get picked up by a games developer who add the polish and refine it, and suddenly you have a bunch of games that wouldn't be getting created.
Yeah, and I think to the point that you made about being an entry point to the industry, that has, in various forms, that's been true for a long time. And the entry point for a staggering number of game developers that I know personally was like Warcraft 3 mods or Half-Life 2 mods, where the game is there, it works, and you can change some of the assets and write a bit of code, and then you create a new experience. And then once you get that working, then you can build on that and maybe you make it more and more advanced. And sometimes people make fully polished new games that are legitimately fun to play that are built on top of these bases. And now that the tools are getting better and barrier to entry just goes lower, then it opens up the possibility for even more people to get into the industry. And I think that has an impact in multiple ways. First, it's game and making games is hard and extra tools are helpful. Mm-hmm. But then also it means that there are more people who will become game developers, which means we'll get more perspectives into the industry. Like, it's not just people who have a programming background or people who happen to have a powerful computer and can run Unreal Engine and these sorts of things. It's like just about anybody can load up some of these tools, some of these like more accessible tools, and build a game and then show that they've got new and interesting ideas, which then will get them into these studios, and it expands the reach of the industry, which is hopeful.
Yeah, I mean, relatedly, I think one of the avenues the piece goes down is talking about this concept of genre entropy, just this idea that, you know, genre is dissolving, and the sort of, you know, previous barriers between sort of passive screen entertainment and interactive media is sort of going away as well. And, you know, they talk about some new shows like The Traitors, Rehearsal, Kaleidoscope that are sort of, you know, exploring these fresh forms of game-like content. I'd be super curious to hear what you're seeing around that. You know, are you seeing genre entropy happen? Are you seeing the dissolving of genre in the gaming sector?
Yeah, genres are... It's sort of a nebulous concept to begin with, because it sort of takes what already is and puts labels on it. Mm-hmm. And then as things change, well, we come up with new labels. And a lot of the boundaries that people push in the games industry is maybe taking two genres and mashing them up and coming up with something new. It's actually very common for people to say, our new game is like, if you take this game and put them together, new game. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a very clean way to describe what you're trying to do, because people understand the components and then they say, oh, I can see how that goes together. That's great. And so I feel like pushing those boundaries on genres is something that's always been done. And I think that'll continue to happen. Pushing the boundaries on media is also interesting where, like, I mean, I personally, as being a heavy gamer, I don't consume a lot of passive entertainment. I often realize it's like, oh, in order to stay up on popular culture, I do need to watch this TV show. So let me figure out how I watch TV shows these days. Do I even have a television anymore? Because most of what I do is video games. There's still value there, but it's like, well, how do you cross those? And storytelling in games has only been getting better as technology improves. Like, we went from maybe a few voice lines in a game because that's all that could fit on the cartridge to multiple movies worth of dialogue throughout the games. And the production value of, like, say, the most recent God of War is absolutely on the level of what they do in movies and TV. Mm-hmm. So the techniques that are used there are definitely impacting games. And then the reverse, I'm sure, is also true. Like, I mean, it's interesting to see how Unreal Engine is used in the production of Mandalorian, for example. Mm-hmm. They just run the backgrounds in real time and project them on a giant screen. And video game development techniques are changing the way movies and TV are being made. And that's always really interesting to me.
Probably worth mentioning, like, Last of Us making a big splash right now. And yeah, just curious to hear your thoughts about that, sort of, if we can call it a crossover. But, like, a lot of folks have played the game and they've you know, in the reviews talked about how much fidelity that the folks at HBO have had to, you know, the game and the storyline and things like that in the show. Just curious to hear if you've been following that. Any thoughts?
Shows that are based on games have kind of been a meme for many decades, and only just recently have we started to get legitimately good pieces, like The Last of Us being a good example. And I guess Arcane is another good example of a show that is really high quality based on a game. People used to think that games and TV or games and movies are just fundamentally different, and that's why the movies are bad or the TV shows are bad. My opinion is that the games industry just wasn't big enough and it didn't justify the investment. They didn't spend enough money, or they weren't able to get the best people to make the movie and TV shows. And then Riot Games brings in Fortiche and they're best of the best. And of course what they produce is amazing because they spend the time, they spend the money. And, like, I'm sure that show costs more than most anything else that's out there, but it's more a matter of resources than portability. And then that's also combined with the fact that storytelling in games is just getting better because the industry is big enough that it justifies the extra expense during the development period where it's like, we can appeal to more people if we have better stories, which means we'll sell more copies, which means we can actually hire better writers, which, and it's all sort of cyclical. And from my perspective, it's a matter of funding and resources rather than portability.
I think as well, to Paul's point, like, there's such an impact of one medium influences the other. Like, video games become a little bit more like Hollywood movies. Hollywood movies become a little more like video games. And then it comes to the point where it's like, well, of course, why wouldn't we adapt the most beloved storytelling video game of all time onto a series? Like, all we talk about is world building. These wonderful gaming nerds have done this for us. Let's just steal their universe, pay them a lot of money, and then put it onto HBO and make a ton. I would have been personally loved how little they've changed of the source material, something that Rings of Power could very much fucking learn from. But it, you know, if a group of very dedicated people who love what they do spend 5 years creating a universe for you, just give it the Hollywood budget it needs and you'll end up with a great series.
Yeah.
Taking us to the third piece, which is a piece from Wired about implications of generative AI potentially revolutionizing game development. The piece kind of takes a bit of a circumspect analysis and saying that, like, you know, it's pretty limited and we haven't seen fundamental change in the gaming industry from generative AI, but kind of points to some specific ways that it could in the future, and kind of, you know, acknowledging that some of the talk's been overblown as much of it has been with AI machine learning. But curious to get your perspective on how it's influenced the gaming sector to date, and where do you think it'll go eventually?
I mean, this is a very current topic. It's interesting because the technology is clearly capable. And the cool thing about AI is that the hype is mostly around results rather than what we saw with Web3, where it was mostly around potential. And so it's like, you can look at the output of some of this stuff and say, oh, that's legitimately good. And then the question is it worth the input to then produce that output? Well, that's still an open question, but the output can be good if you work with it long enough. Anybody who's actually gone and tried some of these tools realizes you get a lot of garbage before you finally get to the good stuff.
Yeah.
But as the tools get better, that time will get shortened. And so there is real potential in the technology. There's no questioning that. The impact that it's had on the industry is very mixed at the moment. One of the most obvious impacts is some of the ethical concerns around the source material going into the AI tools. There's infinite number of opinions on whether it's okay for tools to learn from other artists' art without crediting them or without paying royalties or without copyright. And some people argue, well, that's what humans do. They go to university, they study from the great artists, and then they go and produce their own art. Mm. It's like, well, okay, is AI actually the same as a human? Are they doing the same thing that a human would do? Probably not, but is it different enough that it's a problem? It's a really muddy argument. It's different. Like, we haven't really dealt with this before, at least as a society. And so we're trudging our way through this mud and trying to figure out what makes sense. And I totally get why artists are upset about this, because they work really hard and it's really difficult to be an artist in the industry. Like, there's not that many positions and there's probably more artists than there are available positions. And they're like, if this is going to reduce the number of positions, personally, I'm threatened. Mm-hmm. And then if all of the work that I've done is now being used without my permission and I don't get the profit off of that, mm-hmm. that reduces the value of my position. Like, I get why they're upset. It makes total sense. From my perspective, I think the technology is worth watching, but we do have to be careful with it because I don't think it'll replace artists. The one thing AI doesn't do is have good taste. And that's something that really only artists can provide us. Like, I can look at art and say, well, that's cool, but I don't have as good taste as the art lead at my studio, for example. Mm-hmm. And so I trust him to have good taste and tell us what the game should look like. Somebody has to sift through those results and pick what will actually work. And also, we don't know if it's truly a speed increase. When an artist produces a piece, they'll be working in Photoshop or something else, and they'll produce like hundreds of layers and it's all componentized and it's easy to work with and edit. When AI produces a piece, it's flat. Mm. And that's actually much more difficult to work with. And from a development perspective, maybe that's less efficient. Mm. And maybe even though you got the first piece right away, the amount of iteration after the fact might be more. And like, so we're still trying to figure out if the tools are worthwhile to use right now. And we need to figure out if we can get out of this sort of Napster phase of everybody, of sourcing everybody's work without attribution, and get more into the Spotify phase of, okay, everybody gets paid and it's all ethically sourced and the tools are legitimately useful.
I think VCs have got excited about the idea of building a AAA game with a team of five overseeing it, and that we're many, many years away from that, if it's even possible. I think, like, you know, even in that piece, it was like, maybe you could create some modular landscape builds that then a team of professionals jumps over and like turns into a real universe. And I think the specificity of what we call AI, which is just machine learning, means that like by the time you've given it a data source big enough and given enough parameters on what it's meant to build, you might as well have just built the game yourself. Like, you know, it's like, yeah, if you download every RPG ever made, use that as a source material and then tell it to the detail the RPG you want it to create, it will do a good job. But like, you might as well have hired a team of 30 and just spent 6 months doing that, because it would be the same amount and actually be a much better game with original ideas and story concepts, rather than like sort of the most watered down generic version of what an RPG is at its base element. So yeah, I don't think it's something we need to worry about anytime soon.
Yeah, I think that's an important point that you're making a little subtly there, is AI sort of fundamentally does not innovate.
Mm.
It's really good at taking a bunch of source material and making another thing like that, mm-hmm. which can be very useful, especially if an artist puts a bunch of their own art into the system and then says, make more of what I've already made. It might be good for brainstorming or for concepting or for like the early stages of the pipeline, but for producing something truly innovative and new, well, if the AI has never seen it before, it's not going to do that. It can only do like intersections rather than expansions.
If at any point it does get to a point where it can create stuff that's that good, I just think there'll be a massive backlash in it, and it'll be like fair trade branding, but just like, yeah, this was actually built by humans, and like that there'll be that pushback where it's just like, okay, cool, we have made it good enough that it can replace everyone's jobs. That's not a fucking good thing. You know, there's a small percentage of people that think being able to create this game with no expenditure and pure profit is a good thing, but I don't own this game. And I don't think this is a good thing. And I think that's going to be the next big fight in terms of like ethically fair trade and organic. It'll now be like, was this done with AI or did we pay a team of humans to do it?
You worry about that from like a commercial perspective, right? Because it's like, if you have someone who owns a gaming company and just unleashes an AI to like churn out games and doesn't need to employ humans, and kind of their overhead is super limited, like, what are the implications of that if they're able to just, you know, kind of push those things out and just like crank the profit machine up and down? I mean, it seems a bit worrisome, I guess.
Even if the games are good, I don't know. Maybe I'm putting too much faith in humanity, but I think people would just come back and just be like, I'd rather pay £40 for a game, because the only person benefiting from this is Richie Dickhead with his AI machine. And his,
yeah.
But God knows. I mean, I say that, then someone offers me a £2 Call of Duty experience rather than 70 quid, and I'm like,
change your mind.
I don't really love Activision that much either. So
I
mean, like,
I think you're pointing out the right thing, where it's in people's hearts, they want to believe what you're saying, that like, we want to support the local game developer. We don't want to feed into the big machine. But as many people that have ethical concerns about, say, Amazon.com, almost equal number of people are still subscribing to Prime and getting things delivered in a day and a half, right? And it's when things are sufficiently better, people will move on from complaining and not using to complaining and using, because it's impossible to compete without it. We haven't hit that inflection point yet, but if AI continues to be developed at the pace that it is, I think we will get to a point where it'll be impossible to find something that isn't impacted by AI, art or otherwise. And I think it'll more just be a matter of reality. Like, just about everything has tools that have AI built in. Like, Microsoft is working on like Copilot, and they've got this big investment in OpenAI, where there's a fair chance that a good amount of code written will be written by AI and then massaged and corrected by a human. And then the human's input is more about architecture than it is specific chunks of code. We already use code generation. This is just the next step for that, right? And so a lot of the AI's impacts will be less visible. It's like, you don't see the code running in the software that you use, but maybe it will be written by AI at some point. And if the tools get good enough, it'll be impossible to compete without doing that. And so the real question is probably less, will AI impact us? I think it already is impacting us. And more, can we do it sustainably and ethically and in a way that sort of doesn't make us lose our humanity?
Yeah, I think that particular piece, we aren't there yet, but within our lifetime, 100%, you'll get there within our lifetime, probably within the next 20 years. And like you said, I don't think anyone is planning for that. Like, I think everyone's like, oh, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it, and I'm sure it'll come in like, you know, 200 years' time. It's like, no, and probably into 100% in our lifetime, and probably while we're still relatively young and active.
Well, it's a good transition. Speaking of getting involved and jumping in, wanted to hear a bit more about your work with Sprocket Games, and what was your process to start it? You know, what inspired you to do so, and what was kind of your ultimate goal starting the company?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I was at Google. I was writing large-scale distributed systems in Google Cloud. I was working on cloud CDN and like content, or rather network infrastructure. The people that I worked with were fantastic and some of the best engineers I've ever worked with, but it wasn't games, and I wasn't really feeling, I was missing the multidisciplinary side of game development. I missed working with game designers and artists, and I missed creating beautiful things. Like, global networks are not beautiful except for in a sort of very nerdy way. So I wanted to get back into games. And so when we were looking at moving back to Los Angeles, I was like, well, that's the center of a lot of game development in the US. Maybe I should call up some of my friends that I used to work with at Riot, say like, hey, what are you doing? Maybe we should work together again. And so I ran down a list of studios, interviewed a few, and I had a very specific idea of what I wanted the studio culture to look like. And so when I interviewed, I was very actively interviewing the studio, saying like, this is what I think this should be. And I was looking for friction points, and I didn't actually find a studio that fit all of the things I was looking for, which I believe make a better studio culture. And so after some time, I settled on starting my own studio. It's because I believed pretty firmly that the things that I was looking for were important, and I didn't want to build a studio wrong again. So I called up a friend, Nick Titley, who was at Pragma Platform and was looking to get back into games himself. We started talking about like what we could do together, and I started talking about all the things that I was looking for. And so to go into some of those things, like, I wanted to create a better creative culture that like respected all the perspectives that need to go into game development and had less discrimination, more empowerment, and basically a more stable foundation for people to take the risks that are required to make a creative product like a game. And like, so many, like, I don't know how many news articles that have gone by where this studio has a toxic culture. This studio is a bunch of programmers, or like, it's like whatever it is that they're saying. Like, it seems like every major studio has had some article come out about them. And I've worked in the industry and I've seen a lot of that. And it's a tough place to be. And it's compounded by the fact that making games is a dream job for a lot of people. And so people don't speak out as readily because they're afraid of losing their dream job. It's not like, well, if I lose this job, I'll just get another job somewhere else. It's like, no, they work their whole lives to be in games and they don't want to rock the boat. It's like, this is a really tough place to be. And I'm not going to tell anybody about it because then I might lose my job. And so these cultures perpetuate. And it was my opinion that we needed to basically start from scratch and build a better environment. And then the other side of what I wanted to do was a technology focus. Given my background in software and specifically in like game tools development, like I wrote a lot of the tools that content developers use to get things into the games. And I see the power of really well-built tools in the hands of very creative people. If you give designers and artists really powerful tools, they can create more and more polished things, which is great for players in the game. And so my thesis was, if we start with a technology focus and build the right tools early, the cost of the development of those tools will amortize very quickly, and we will see the benefits much earlier in game development, and we can set the trajectory for the potential of the game much steeper. And so I took that pitch to VCs and ultimately landed a term sheet with Bitcraft, who is now our lead investor, and we hired a bunch of people.
The first time we ever spoke was he'd seen an article that we had been featured in about the four-day work week and working fully remotely, and just wanted to pick our brains about like how to make a really lovely work culture for folk that aren't in the same office together. So yeah, definitely been doing the hard graft in creating that awesome culture for the studio. You guys have relatively new, but you've got some cool stuff in the pipeline. Is there anything you can kind of give our audience a sneak peek about some of the games that you're developing? You've got one big one in the horizon, don't you?
We're building one game right now. I mean, that's full focus is on our first game. We're about 6 months into development, so there's not a whole lot exciting to show. I mean, one of the key skills you develop as a game developer is your ability to squint. Is like, I can see that maybe eventually that will be cool, because we haven't built enough of it to make it actually cool. And so if I were to show you, say, a screenshot, you'd be like, wow, that's a terrible game. It's like, well, yeah, that's supposed to be at this level because we're building the foundation and we have maybe one piece of bespoke art in the game and everything else is stock and not interesting. And it's actually a risk to share things early because most of the world doesn't have the ability to squint, and they'll say, oh, it's just a bad game, and then they'll move on to other things. It's like, I don't have time for a bad game. So that's one of the reasons why game studios are often very secretive, is because people don't understand what it means to have an early stage game. For that much, it'll probably be maybe another 6 or 12 months before we have bring in external playtesters. I mean, we'll bring in a few like very focused playtests or like either concept tests sometimes, where just to get people's opinions on characters and this sort of thing, but not so much public today. As far as like what our focus is, probably the thing that interests me the most about what we're doing is understanding the way that people are socializing has changed in the last like 5-10 years, where if you see kids used to like come home from school and maybe they would go to the mall to hang out, or they go to the movies to hang out. Like, this is maybe when I was a kid, like, you know, 20 years ago or something. Now that internet is so good and online game experiences are so solid, a lot of times people come home and they log on to Minecraft, or they come home and they log on to Roblox, or they come home and they log on to Fortnite, and then all of their friends are there and they can load up their favorite skins of their characters and show off how cool they are, a lot of self-expression. And it's actually a much more empowering experience and a much more fulfilling experience. And it is just sort of their default social hub. And so a lot of what we think about is, how can we make that experience more fulfilling and really serve people's needs to be that like second platform for people to make friends? And so that starts to sound a lot like metaverse and what people are talking about there. But once again, we've been doing this for 30, 40 years in games, and we're just continuing that.
Yeah, Minecraft is 100% a metaverse. It is every VC pitch that's ever been around a metaverse. It's like, yeah, you just described Minecraft, mate.
Which, when did that come out?
Yeah.
Like 15 years ago, something like that.
Yeah, I used to have it on my phone.
On the topic of creating like a fulfilling space and one, maybe, you know, you spoke very nobly in the beginning about wanting to create like a different context for gaming and things like that. But just curious about your perspective on safety and creating like a safe space for particularly teens to, you know, hopefully not experience what oftentimes comes along with gaming, which is a bit of online bullying and stuff like that. So how are y'all thinking about that at Sprocket Games?
Yeah, so that's a really tough one. And like, given a lot of our people come from Riot Games and League of Legends, we're very familiar with just how difficult it is to police online behavior. Like, League of Legends is sort of renowned for its community, and sometimes it's very good, but the sort of meme ability is that it's very toxic, and that's a constant battle, and it's almost an arms race where you build better tools to police it, and then the internet builds better trolls to sidestep your policing. And so we know that it's an extremely difficult problem to solve, and it's also important to know that I am personally not an expert in that, and I can't just let it happen. And so the first and foremost, my strategy will be to hire people who are experts and give them the resources to then go and build the systems that we can make people safe. A couple of things that I think about is just, it seems like anonymity and a lot of free access to communication channels tends to amplify this behavior, especially in like a free-to-play game where anybody can make an account and there's no real punishment to getting banned for doing something. If you just have a big public channel, somebody's going to be harassing somebody in it. And so trying to put the focus more on people that you know and are friends with, and more on go on adventures with your friends rather than any random person, that's one step in the right direction, but it's a huge problem to solve, and it's one that we'll have to spend a lot of time thinking about how it makes sense in the context of the game that we make.
Yeah, we're going to jump into the lightning round, which tends to be kind of like interesting, fun questions, a bit more personal, and want to get your perspective as an individual on a couple of things. First question, what kind of tech stack do you work with as a gamer, as a leader of a gaming company? And if there's been a game-changing piece of tech in your life, we'd love to hear about it.
Let's see. So we are relatively standard in our tech stack for today. The studio is working on Unreal 5, a commercial game engine. Mm-hmm. And given that we're deep in prototyping land, most of the work we do is just in the engine, building on top of the engine, and extending what it can do for the specific things we need our game to do. And so that'll be the reality for probably the next year or two. As far as like game-changing technologies, I was very impressed by the giant step forward that Unreal 5 is over Unreal 4. It's very clear that Epic values like usability and collaboration with the way that the engine is shaped up.
What is one problem that tech can't solve for us, and why?
Most of the human side of life is difficult for tech to solve. And so, and I say that very generically, because like when I talk about things like AI doesn't have good taste, well, that's because AI isn't human and doesn't, so tech can't solve that part of the equation. But even going a little bit further, like some of the biggest challenges in building something big and complex like a video game, those are human problems. Those are collaboration problems. How do we interact with each other? How do we make people psychologically safe so that they can take risks around other humans? That's a problem that each individual needs to contribute to solving in the culture of the studio or the culture of the whatever company that's working on the big problem. And so that level of psychological safety is a much harder problem than almost any technology problem that we have. Mm-hmm. And technology doesn't solve that problem.
Yeah. Somewhat relatedly, our signature tech for bad question, what's the evilest application of tech that you've seen out there?
I think the one that stands out to me, I mean, it's hard to compete with like sort of the atrocities of war, which are often technology-based. More relatably, it's sort of disappointingly fascinating how effective humans are at taking advances in technology and then exploiting other people with them. And so people have scammed other humans since the beginning of time. It's like, I sell you a box, I tell you there's something inside of it, and then it's empty. Oh, that's a scam, right? That's a one person to one person scam. And you might have stolen $20 from me. What we've seen with, say, crypto in the last couple of years is we can now scam people at scale. We can now have 1 to 10 million people scams, and like with rug pulls and other things. That's the technology fundamentally isn't causing that problem, but the people using the technology are like, oh wow, I can reach the whole world with this scam, so let me do it. And then they steal millions of dollars and run off, just like the selling an empty box scam. They rug pull the NFT and then now they run away with all the money. And so it's just like, it's much more evil because of how many people are impacted by it.
That is a very, very good answer to that question.
You kind of already mentioned it in terms of a games engine built on Rust, but if there was any other tech product that you could sort of dream up and create and invent, what would it be and what would it do?
I could give a more direct answer to that one. I would love a bullshit detector. Like, because technology is getting so good at creating bullshit that it's getting hard to tell reality from not in a lot of cases. And like, and it's sometimes they're funny applications where like ChatGPT writes an essay and it's just, it's not true at all, but it's really believable because it's written reasonably well. And it would be great to just be able to say, oh, yep, that's clearly fake. But then it's more, much more insidious where you have like deep fake technology where you can make Barack Obama say whatever you want. And then you've got a video of it too. And if you're not paying close attention, you might believe it. I know people are working on tools to detect those sorts of like fake things, but I would love one with 100% accuracy.
And platforms that actually use them. Facebook could solve a lot of misinformation if it wanted to, but it lets your crazy drunk uncle share that video of Barack Obama saying things that he hasn't said, and they know that it is what it is, and they don't want to take it down. So yeah, to your previous point, it's always the human element that fucks up. We'd probably solve a lot of it if we cared.
It's not an episode of Tech Can't Save Us unless there's a Facebook rant at some point.
Fuck you, Facebook.
Looking ahead, what's one prediction you have for the tech space in 2023 this year? And it can be particular to gaming as well. What do you see coming?
Yeah, I think it's hard because things like with the macroeconomic conditions shifting so quickly, it's really hard to figure out where we're going. I think, like, because it's like we were sort of on a steady upward trend in gaming for such a long time, and then we got really comfortable there. It's like, well, games are always going up. Doesn't matter what the rest of the world is doing. It's like, well, games have at least plateaued, if not declined a little bit in the last year. It's like, is that a hiccup or is that going to continue? It's hard. Similar to what we talked about earlier, I do wonder if we'll see people trying to take a step back from technology because people have been burned so much by it. Like, social media seemed great until we got burned by it. And AI seems great, but people are starting to get burned by it. Or crypto seemed great, but we're getting burned by it. It's like, how many times do we get burned by technology before we stop trying new technology? Like, if you get burned every time, you're just going to stop. As a software engineer, I'm much more optimistic about things, and I'm more willing to try things that are not quite functional. But your average person who just wants to get through their day relatively efficiently, they're very potentially just going to pull back, and it'll be harder to sell people on new tech. We might see some of that if the burning continues. But that's not really gaming specific. With gaming, I do think we're going to see the very clear difference between, say, game studios who jump on new technology and sort of exploit it for the hype, and ones that sort of thread the needle and apply it where it's useful. And I hope Sprocket will be one of the second groups, but it's really hard, right? It's like AI seems to be really powerful. How do we apply it in a way that is both ethical and effective? That's really hard. And I hope we get it right. There will be studios who get it completely wrong and they're just going to fizzle.
Yeah, it's funny. Prepping for this, I had that thought. Like, is the human nature, like the life cycle of all technology, is the first 5 years it's just totally fucking abused by charlatans, and then adults come in the room and go, here's some stuff you can do with NFTs that isn't evil. Because that's what happened with the internet. The first time the internet came around, there's the massive clicks boom, totally crashed, everyone went, oh, this is a passing fad. And then the adults came in the room and were like, hey, have you heard of this thing called Google? It's super useful. And you kind of hope that, yeah, maybe with the latter half of this decade, we start to see that kind of adults in the room. Look, I know that you associate NFTs with 17-year-olds trying to rug pull you, but here's some genuinely interesting stuff you can do with them that's for the betterment of humanity. Last question of the lightning round and end of the podcast. I mean, you kind of already gave us the backstory of Sprocket Games, and a lot of it is embodying this question where you've looked to build a career that, you know, doesn't just combine, you know, your professional skill set, but also kind of your passion and purpose. You're over a year in now. Like, how much better is the change? Like, how are you reaping the rewards of having taken that move away from something great and cool at Google, but not really your passion and not what wakes you up in the middle of the night excited, to Sprocket Games?
Yeah, I think one of the most rewarding parts of what we've done at Sprocket is how successful we've been at hiring. When we were starting this studio, and in fact, many people told us the hardest thing that we will have to do is hire people. It'll be really hard to find people willing to jump to a new studio who's unproven, and you're not going to have that much money, and you might just have to like fill seats with whoever will come. That hasn't been the case. And in fact, we've turned away people saying we just don't have enough slots for everybody who wants to join Sprocket. And it's been very validating to our thesis that if we just build a better culture, then people will do better work.
Well, we really thank you for your time, Josiah. It's been an awesome conversation. Everything from ethics and gaming, safety, Web3, genre entropy. We've really covered a lot.
A genuine discussion at one point about whether tech can save us, which is we don't often have. We actually, yeah. Despite the name of the podcast, don't often have.
Yeah, it's been a really good conversation. And we'll have to have you back at some point and maybe do a panel or something like that. So
yeah, that would be fun.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we really thank you for your time. This has been another episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. A lot of gratitude to our guest, Josiah Keel, CEO of Sprocket Games. Thanks again, Josiah.
Thank you. It's been fun.
And don't forget to subscribe, like, share the podcast with everyone. Please give us a 5-star rating if you can. Really need that to keep bringing on great guests like Josiah here. So thank you all.